This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, the Bush administration issued a national strategy for pandemic influenza that many will find alarming. The plan includes the possibility of quarantines and travel restrictions. All levels of government and private businesses are asked to plan for waves of illness that could continue for months. Hospitals and clinics are warned to prepare for the possibility of mass panic. Right now, there is no flu pandemic here or anywhere else in the world. The bird flu we keep hearing about is a disease of animals. So far, only about 120 people have contracted the disease, and it does not spread from person to person. But history and science suggest that either this strain or another will jump from birds to people and could spread rapidly. There were three flu pandemics in the 20th century. Odds are we'll get another one sooner or later. The president's plan calls for $7.1 billion to ramp up vaccine technology, stockpile drugs, monitor outbreaks, help local governments, and help other countries where any pandemic is likely to start. Later in the program, the secret prisons where the CIA holds top leaders of Al-Qaeda, but first the plan to cope with the possibility of a flu pandemic. If you have questions about what's in the plan and what isn't, whether this is too much or too little, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Richard Knox, NPR science correspondent. Richard's been very, very busy today reading through all 300-plus pages of this plan. Nice of you to join us today, Richard.
Glad to be with you, Neil.
And those scary terms I mentioned at the beginning, a quarantine, travel restrictions, mass panic, those are all used to really describe the worst-case scenario. They're describing 1918.
Yeah, they are, and they feel that they have to really assume the worst because it could be that bad. The signs are pretty ominous. If you look at what's happened with this bird flu virus in Asia, even though it has not acquired and may not acquire the ability to jump easily from person to person to person, still, that's apparently how it happened in the past. In 1918, according to some recent scientific studies, the virus that caused that global catastrophe was a largely, if not entirely, bird virus. So it can happen. I think they assume that it might happen.
And this is not to talk about the flu vaccine that many of us will be getting shots for in the next couple of months. These are the normal seasonal kind of flu things. They're no protection against bird flu or this pandemic that we're talking about.
No, flu vaccines have to be very specific, which is why they have to create a new one every year. And it's slightly different because the virus tends to drift genetically from year to year to year. And occasionally it will not only drift, but make a big shift. That big shift change in the virus is the start of a pandemic. And there will need to be a vaccine created for that particular strain when it emerges. Until then, what we have is an experimental vaccine that's in clinical trials now in some people that is made against this bird flu vaccine or virus that's in Asia. They hope that's going to be close enough to what emerges as a pandemic strain to be somewhat protective, but we don't know yet.
Well, the briefing that you were at today, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Mike Leavitt, said vaccines are the foundation of this plan, which is a sort of an interesting term because right now they don't have a vaccine.
Yeah, I was interested to hear him say that this is the cornerstone of the whole plan is the vaccine, because if that's the case, then we're kind of in trouble. That's a sobering point, because he also said, and other people in HHS said today, they hope to have 20 million doses of this experimental vaccine I just talked about, the avian flu vaccine, available maybe, next year not until 2009. Mm-hmm. So we're really not very close to even having that one available in any quantities that mean anything. And we're certainly further off, maybe as far as 2013, from having a newfangled vaccine that's based upon new kinds of technology called cell-based technology. It doesn't require chicken eggs to make it and can be made faster.
Or 9 months to make it, yeah. If we're in this period then of sort of crossing our fingers and toes and waiting until new kinds of vaccine technology are available from 5 to 10 years from now, this plan calls for coping with the possibility of a pandemic in the meantime. And it's talking about an awful lot of low-tech approaches to this.
Yeah, if you think about it, we don't have a whole lot more tools in our arsenal to combat a pandemic than they did in 1918. Now, that's a bit of an overstatement. We do have antiviral drugs, and we'll probably want to get into that a bit later. We do have much better ways of doing what they call surveillance, which is casting about, looking at closely at viruses that emerge and cases that emerge, and trying to see, well, is this virus or that virus? I mean, after all, in 1918, they didn't know what a virus was. So, we have lots of things that that tell us what's coming better, and that's a very useful thing to know. But when it comes to actually combating it when it arrives, I think we're going to be thrown back, if it happens anytime soon, on pretty classic public health measures, which are not high tech, they're not fancy, they're no quick fixes. They have to do with trying to get people to take themselves out of circulation.
Wash your hands a lot. If you're sick, stay home from work.
Absolutely. Those kinds of common sense things that that we hear about all the time in connection with ordinary flu, but we're going to really have to be rigorous about them if a pandemic appears.
Mm-hmm. And then there are all sorts of contingency plans for the possibility if, and again, you're talking the worst case scenario, if a quarter of the American population simultaneously gets sick.
Yeah, that's certainly going to put an intolerable strain on the healthcare system, among other things. First of all, we have about 1 million hospital beds in the country that are staffed. By some estimates, a pandemic might require 4.7 million people to seek hospital care. So that by itself shows you we've got a big, big problem.
Let's bring some more voices into the conversation. By the way, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Many of us have questions about how President Bush's plan will help them in the event of a pandemic and how the government created this plan. It's been in the works since the 1970s. For more on how we fit into the flu pandemic strategy, we turn to Dr. Michael Osterholm, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He's also the former state epidemiologist for Minnesota's Department of Public Health, and he joins us now from the Time Magazine Global Health Summit in New York. Nice to have you on the program, Doctor.
Good afternoon, Neil.
As we saw with Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans had a plan that did not help a lot in the event. Does this flu plan go far enough, do you think?
Well, as Richard really laid out, this is a plan largely about the future, meaning that what it's an attempt to do is secure the vaccines and the drugs that we might need that are going to be years down the road for a pandemic. What we also need to do is plan for what if it happens tonight. Mm-hmm. And that really is, in part, well beyond the scope of just the Department of Health and Human Services. Are we going to have a food supply that's intact? Because once the global economy crashes, which it will, I have no doubt about that, and transportation becomes very problematic, we aren't going to see this just-in-time global economy function as we see it every day. And so one of the things we're also having to look at is that issue of what happens if it happens tonight. How will we handle bodies? How will we handle the kinds of medicines that we take for granted that have nothing to do with the flu, but that are every day produced somewhere offshore and brought to this country? And so I think that the discussion really needs to move to that today, as well as the idea of the vaccine and the drug for tomorrow, and help everyone understand that there's no cavalry coming in to rescue each of the communities in this country when this happens.
We want to hear your questions on this subject. What's in the report? What isn't? Do you think it goes too far? Not far enough? 800-989-8255. And let's get a caller on the line. And this is, not having a good time getting... Well, the phones are not cooperating. The phones are not cooperating, and so we'll get to get some help on that technical level in just a bit and get to your questions as soon as we can. Dr. Osterholm, let me ask you, one of the questions $7 billion sounds like an awful lot of money, but a lot of the financial burden is not going to fall on the federal government, but on state and local governments to purchase antiviral drugs for that sort of thing, to create these plans, to rehearse the plans as they're asked to do in this national strategy. Is this going to cost a lot more than $7.1 billion?
It is, and I think, again, just to follow up on Richard's introduction here, we must remember that pandemic influenza is really like tsunamis, earthquakes, and hurricanes. It occurs. It's not something that is a possibility. It is going to happen. It's just a matter of when, where, and how bad. And as we know, this dates all the way back to antiquity, when we knew we had these bursts of illnesses and deaths in people. What you're hearing about today is a possibility of a 1918-like pandemic where 50 to 100 million people worldwide died at a time when the world's population was only one-third of what it is today, and a time when we didn't have fast jet air travel around the world. And so one of the things that we want to emphasize is that preparedness for pandemics will never be wasted, ever. Mm-hmm. It will happen again. The second point is that when a pandemic occurs, and we saw this with SARS and we saw it with anthrax, even though they were what we would call limited hits with limited number of cases, it caused a great deal of consternation in the countries where they occurred. And in the Asia and parts of Canada, there was major financial implications to what happened. Another pandemic will cost the world many, many billions of dollars. The idea of just what we're investing in is really quite limited compared to what it will cost us.
I understand. But Richard Knox, as we paint that picture, that's one possibility. There were two other pandemics during the 20th century that were not so bad.
That's right. In fact, the last one was kind of wimpy, according to many people. I think one of the intrinsic problems in planning for something like this is that you got to do it. If you don't, you're pretty foolish, especially when you got these ominous signs on the near horizon. On the other hand, if it doesn't happen in the next few months, if it doesn't happen in the next year, or two, and we'll be all terrifically lucky if it doesn't, because we can't possibly be, quote, ready in any meaningful sense, then will we have the crying wolf syndrome? Will people say, well, you know, this was last year's problem, and we have other competing priorities?
We're talking about the possibility of a flu pandemic. The government today published a strategy to cope with the possibility of something on the order of the 1918 disaster that killed so many millions of people. I think we've got the phone problems sorted out. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, or send us email questions, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about bird flu and a national strategy to prepare for a possible pandemic. Later this hour, the CIA's secret prisons in foreign countries, the places where they hold top Al-Qaeda leaders. But let's get back to avian flu. Our guests are NPR science correspondent Richard Knox and Mike Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Of course, you're invited to join us at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to a caller, and Mike is on the line from Philadelphia.
Hi, I love your show.
Thank you.
My question is, as a citizen, I understand that bird flu is an issue, and it probably will happen. But I'm wondering how much of this is political and how much is real.
When you say political, what do you mean?
Well, considering the Bush administration's recent issues, is this just how much of a political effort is it for him to be diverting this? All of a sudden it's an issue at the White House.
Mm-hmm.
How much is real?
Dr. Osterholm.
Well, let me just say that if you were to bring together the world's experts on influenza, you will find almost complete agreement. And I say almost because some may say how much is likely to occur or that type of thing, that another pandemic is going to happen and that this is nothing at all political. If you look at the WHO, they have issued dire warnings also about this. And even to reflect on how we might look at this, Neil, just before we went to break,
mm-hmm.
we were talking about the severity of this issue. And one of the reasons why we bring up 1918 is not just because it's a worst-case scenario, but there are many parallels between the 1918 virus that's been recently reconstructed and that of the H5N1 or avian bird virus, both in terms of how it kills, the kinds of illness it creates, and so forth. And even as Richard pointed out earlier, we now know that the 1918 virus actually originated by jumping literally from birds to humans. It didn't go through another thing we call reassortment or mixing with a human and bird virus. So the reason we're concerned about this, and the reason why I think the caller's question is a very fair one, but one that I can say across the scientific community is an absolute, is we really are very concerned as a science community about this, and we're just very glad that the White House and the administration has seen fit to understand that and to try to take action.
I think the one thing that's worth pointing out is that even though this White House and this president is clearly very disaster-minded right now and disaster-planning-minded, the people in his administration who have been worrying about this have been talking to him about it for long before Katrina and long before his current plunge in the polls. Former Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson, when he left office last year, said this was his number one sleep-losing problem. He really put it at the top of the list, and I think that the people we're talking to him, the current secretary and others, Julie Gerberding of the CDC and Tony Fauci, have been pressing on this president to put out this plan for some time.
Mike, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's turn now to Che, and Che's with us from Edwardsville, Illinois.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
The question is, how would delivery of bird flu, would they be equity? Would it be socioeconomic? Would it be need? Would it be territorial? As we know in New Orleans, the situation about delivery of aid, there was some talk about it being thwarted because of the socioeconomic status of those individuals.
So you're talking about the distribution of either
the vaccine or
a drug to a therapeutic drug.
That's right. If millions of people are ill.
Yeah. Who gets it? They're talking about rationing. Richard Knox. Who gets it? Who doesn't?
They certainly are talking about rationing, and I think that's a very important threshold that's been crossed today. I can't recall another time in which the government has so explicitly said we're going to have to ration this potentially life-saving vaccine or treatment. We ration implicitly all the time, but this is very explicit. And there's a lot of detail in this plan. We probably can't get into too much of it today. But the plan calls for 20 million courses of experimental vaccine, which wouldn't go very far. And they say the most essential medical workers and people who make the vaccine would be first in line. They would add up to about more than 9 million. The next group is high-risk people over 65. That's 18 million people. So you can see if there's only 20 million doses, we're going to run out even before we get to those two groups.
So you're talking about a panic. This would definitely cause a panic because of this rationing.
People are specifically warned about panic, Dr. Osterholm.
And I think that this is one of the reasons why we're urging people to begin planning now for the kinds of things that are going to occur without a world of vaccine or drugs. And again, you know, I would remind everyone, as dire as this sounds, even under our worst-case scenario, 98 out of 100 people will still be around at the end of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the end of civilization as we know it, and that's been an unfortunate misconception by some. But we also saw in Katrina, even among the survivors, the pain and agony that occurs when you're not prepared to, in a sense, come in and assist them with everyday life. And now we're talking about a situation where a pandemic could last 12 to 18 months or more. And so this is why preparedness is really important. And again, we're going to get through this, and most of us will, but we've got to be prepared for these other issues. And I think that's the kind of thing that this caller is asking about. Will that be equitable?
Right.
And I think there's a fair attempt being made right now to do that in a kind of a pre-deployment kind of way.
Richard Knox, in terms of fairness, this is a government report. Where do government officials rate on the list in terms of prioritizing for therapeutic drugs or vaccine?
None at the top, they say. I think that's like in one graphic here among these 396 pages where they're like fifth in line for, I can't remember if that's antivirals or vaccine. But there are, you know, they do say that other people, for instance, those who are hospitalized now with serious illness would get the first doses of antiviral medicines.
But there could be no, we can't dodge the fact that this would cause terrible, terrible quandaries. I mean, for one thing, it says that among those who would not be vaccinated, for example, it said would be include people with HIV, people with cancer, people who've had transplants, household contacts of infants who've got the disease. Those are terrible, terrible decisions.
Well, Neil, if I could just add to that, I mean, there's even a further element to this which adds to the problematic nature of trying to decide what to do. as Richard has said, we're not going to really have that vaccine early. We're not going to have a stockpile of drugs, and even among Tamiflu, we're not sure how well it'll work with this infection, even though we know it works well with other influenza viruses, and that's a whole other topic of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But the third line of defense that we would use in the healthcare setting, for example, are masks. Basically a way to protect you from breathing in that virus. And again, in this global just-in-time economy world, we have two companies on a worldwide basis that own over 90% of the market share for making the respirator kind of mask that we would use. All their production is offshore. They're currently operating almost at 100% capacity because in this day and age of that global just-in-time economy, inventory is a horrible concept. And we have no surge capacity. I worry desperately, and this is one of the things we need to plan for, how will we ask our healthcare workers to come to work with no vaccine, with no mask, and no effective drug? That's the kind of planning we have to embark upon now. And as horrible as that sounds, this is a reality.
Jay, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks for taking it.
Let's talk with Barry. Barry's calling from Minneapolis.
Yes, good afternoon. This is a very great topic you're talking about, and very timely. As we are right now in the midst of a delay and shortage of our annual vaccine production, and my concern is if we're talking about a pandemic and we only have 20 million doses, we only basically have in this country three manufacturers now who are certified to manage production, and we can't even get vaccine for this year's flu strains on a timely basis to those high-risk patients who 2 weeks ago should have been vaccinated. The document talks about the government taking and determining and signaling to manufacturers when to shift from annual vaccine to pandemic vaccine. We are still bogged down by the release of this year's vaccine, and it appears that any attempt to try and change this is going to require massive changes in the manufacturing process and certainly not only the priority but the distribution process, because it's inequitable at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be very interested to hear what Dr. Osterholm and your other participants think about this. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Barry. And let me begin with you, Richard. What does the plan actually say about about the problems that he was talking about in terms of manufacturing and distribution?
It spends a lot of these pages. By the way, you can look at the document at the website called pandemicflu.gov. It spends a lot of pages on this very problem, and in fact does propose to do just what our caller says needs to be done, namely revolutionize the vaccine production, first of all technology, and then production and distribution system. A large part of the $7.1 billion that the president proposed yesterday would go towards incentivizing the manufacturers, providing federal money for new technologies, because you can't expect the companies to invest in untested technologies for which there's an uncertain market. I think we've never really tried to do this before, but it is a major attempt by the federal government to change a whole sector of the pharmaceutical industry to meet this kind of need.
And Dr. Osterholm, based on what we saw in terms of the flu vaccine last year in particular, I think a lot of people are not going to be all that confident that this industry is now ready to cope with this new problem.
Well, first of all, they're not ready, and that is the given. We have to understand right now that from a technological standpoint, we're using a 1950s vaccine. It's the same vaccine with one exception at the time we use slide rules. And so we have to understand that that has to be revolutionized, and that will not happen overnight. Second of all, we can't produce more vaccine because we don't have the plants, we don't have the equipment, we don't have the expertise. That will take years to build. I feel like we're kind of like the guy who's going to his 25th class reunion tomorrow and he decides tonight he wants to lose 50 pounds. It isn't going to happen. The best he can do is get a new suit that fits, a smile, and polish your shoes and go, and know that that's going to be a long-term proposition. And so that's the part that I think is really critical for the public to understand. It's not about how much money you have right now. You can't buy what we haven't made or that we haven't built. I think a second piece, Neil, that's really critical here about this whole issue of what we're approaching is we are also American-centric on this issue right now in a way that really concerns me. While our government has to be focused on the safety of American citizens, if there is a worldwide pandemic and we somehow escape most of it by having a vaccine, the rest of the world will still experience it, and the global economy will still crash. And many of the everyday products and services, including critical medications, will not make it to our country. So we have an absolute interest in the best interest of the world. And I think that's one part that's been missing in this discussion. We have to build an international vaccine infrastructure, not just a U.S. vaccine infrastructure.
But based on what I read of the plan, Richard Knox, it goes on and on about international partners and the World Health Organization and all of these, you know, beginning in Vietnam, where they're testing this this experimental vaccine now.
Yeah, well, it does talk a lot about international cooperation and flow of money from America to places like Vietnam to help them test their vaccine and increase their ability to detect flu early. On the other hand, one very telling point, and Secretary Leavitt stressed it today, is that the prime objective is to get enough vaccine manufacturing capability in this country to service Americans, because they assume that in the event of a pandemic, all countries would nationalize their supply of vaccine, and it would not go outside those countries' borders, and it would not go outside America's borders either to the people who don't have vaccine manufacturing capability, which is, of course, most of the world.
We're talking about the administration's newly published plan to cope with the possibility of an influenza pandemic. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email question, this from Elizabeth. Does the plan discuss recommendations for families and individuals that they might stockpile food and water to get through the first pandemic wave without having to go out? For how long? We prepare for earthquakes in California. What about making pandemic preparedness just part of everybody's emergency supply? And what about recommendations for schools, opening and closings, some of the low-tech suggestions that we were talking about earlier, Richard?
Well, I'll have to riffle through this. Those are very good questions. I must admit, I was focused more on the rationing of vaccines and antivirals than on that. But in short, and as I say, you can look at the plan yourself, but in short, online, they are talking about many things that individuals should be thinking about in advance and be prepared to do. Schools will probably have to be closed when the pandemic hits our shores. Businesses, too. Travel will have to be restricted, perhaps. People will have to, businesses will be closed. Public events will be restricted and so on.
Mm. Yep. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Sharon. Sharon calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a nurse and have been for 20-some years now. And so I've heard a lot about, I keep my ear open for the medical news that's out there. And, of course, there's been a lot of other fears, a lot of other viruses and viral things that have come up. What makes this so very different? And also, why is it that it's coming out right now? I've heard that a lot of the pharmaceutical companies and maybe even some people in government are going to be making a whole lot of money on these vaccinations. Have you heard anything about that?
Richard Knox?
Well, Mike Ostrom can also talk to this very eloquently, but what makes this so different is that flu is really different. It's one of the most contagious infectious diseases we know. It passes very quickly from individual to individual. It has a very short incubation period, a day or two, and between the time people are exposed and the time they get sick. People can pass on the infection before they start to show symptoms. It makes it a very difficult disease to try to do anything about. And if you think about SARS, for instance, there was a longer lag between infection and symptoms. I think maybe we can come back to the question of how much money for vaccines.
Well, Dr. Osterholm, could you address that part of it?
Sure. Well, let me just follow up a bit on what Richard said. He gave a good explanation for this. But among those of us who work in infectious diseases, influenza historically has been considered the lion king of infectious diseases. It is one of the most infectious agents that we know. You're actually infected and capable of transmitting before you even get ill. And many of the other quote-unquote scares that have occurred out there have been scares that have basically been related to what the media called a scare. SARS was an example. In public health terms, that was not something that threatened the vast majority of the world, nor did we ever think so. And so I would just say, from the actual professionals who deal with infectious diseases, think about HIV/AIDS. As horrible as it has been, has killed only, and I say that sadly, only 34 million people in 30 years. influenza very readily could kill 180 million people in a year. And that's what we have to help the world understand, is that this is not just somebody out there, you know, yelling fire in a theater when there is none. There is a real potential here, and again, it happens. It's like hurricanes, tsunamis, and earthquakes. It happens.
Sharon, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to defer further conversation for another day. Dr. Osterholm, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Michael Osterholm is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota and a professor at the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. And he joined us by phone from the Time Magazine Global Health Summit in New York. Richard Knox was with us here in Studio 3A. He's a science correspondent for NPR. Richard, thanks very much.
Anytime.
When we come back from a short break, the CIA detains top Al-Qaeda leaders in secret prisons. We know more about where they are. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.